This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
So today, I'm joined by Robert Stark, Starkian Hypothesis, longtime mutual, writer on many interesting things. One of his latest sort of ingenious ideas, Cosmoplatonism. I think that's what Robert wants to talk about. But Robert, plug yourself, intro yourself, and give people just a broad idea of who you are and the kind of work that you do and the sort of thinking that you're doing right now.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I've been a podcaster on Stark Truth Radio for over a decade, and I've been on Substack for several years now, and I'm also an artist, and I've done some different documentary films on YouTube, but my Substack, it's mostly been like politics, philosophy, like demographics, but lately I've really been getting into spirituality and mysticism, and I propose this new religion, Cosmoplatonism, but I think the religion is totally compatible or syncretic with a lot of the political and philosophical issues I've talked about. So I have this article, The Metaphysics of My New Religion, Cosmoplatonism, and yeah, I thought about different names for the religion, and like I thought about the Church of Divine Emanations, but that sounded like too much like a 70s cult. And then I was like thinking about like cosmodeism, but like cosmotheism, like that's associated with like William Pierce's religion. So I obviously don't want to use that. And I just decided upon like Cosmoplatonism, maybe. Yeah, that's really what I decided upon. And I've been talking about starting a new religion for several years, and there's a podcast I did with Matt Pegus several years ago about starting a new religion, but that was in the very early stages. Like, I would recommend listening to it, and I can send you a link really quick.
Yeah, I'll definitely, if you send it to me, Robert, I'll definitely include it in the show notes, and everybody can go, and including me.
Okay, great.
To listen to it after, for sure.
But yeah, like, that was in the really early stages, so if you listen to that podcast, it was, like, much more kind of an open-ended discussion. But at this point, like I actually put forth an actual like metaphysical structure. And I would say it's been a kind of long journey. It's personal prayer contemplation mixed in with research of various things from studying near-death experiences to observing nature to studying philosophy and different types of religions, spirituality and metaphysics online. So it's a long process based on contemplation, research, and just intuition.
Why don't we discuss some of the, well, first of all, I want to shout out Mark Vallon because he and I did a discussion on Zelda, which was really interesting. So I noticed that you have the Triforce logo, which of course we'll get into.
Perhaps a fan of Zelda, playing it as a kid in the 90s. I forget the names, if it was Nintendo 64, like Zelda Link to the Past, and then the ones that came after that. I've lost track of the names, but the ones that came out after 2000. But I think like the symbol, the Triforce, I guess it's kind of you would say analogous in some ways to like the Christian Trinity, which has some Neoplatonic influence via the theologian Origen. But it represents the Triforce, can be a metaphor for the metaphysics. So you have the divine source, the divine consciousness, and the avatars, and that's what that is representative of.
Okay, so that's interesting from my perspective. So why don't we also get into some of the influences that you list right off the bat? Because I think you actually point to something you have an inclination to suggest, perhaps it's a theosophical exercise or theosophical adjacent. So instantly when I read the article, I thought, yeah, this makes sense to me, because theosophy really is just the inclination to synthesize and syncretize. It's really the philosophy of religion, in my opinion. And so I think that any inclination that seeks to sort of restore or rectify or even compare, that is theosophical in nature. And so when people do that, that's theosophical. I don't know if you agree with that or not agree with that, but that's sort of the things I gleaned from it.
Oh, yeah. Theosophy, the idea that all religions offer some path to the divine. And I believe in that, but it's not necessarily like egalitarianism that all religions are equally true. The metaphysical explanation is there are these divine emanations and they react to different groups in history, how they form, factoring in their history, their geographic circumstances, biology, how they react to divine emanations. So they form different religions that way. And there is there's still a hierarchy, because you have like the divine truth, which is based upon the levels of emanation, how close they are to the divine source. Then you have these other factors that are circumstantial, like geography, history, circumstances, biology, genetics, etc. And that's sort of how religion is formed. So from within all religions, you get partial truths and some partial distortions and corruption, just because of human nature and the abuse of power and how human psychology, whether it's the level of consciousness attained, how close it is to the divine. But at the same time, like, I'm not saying all religions are equal either. There's still going to be hierarchy. But at the same time, even though like there is a hierarchy, I don't want to like express my bias too much, because I do. At the same time, there's some degree of subjectivity, because people do have their own biases based on what religions they grew up in or what religions are more suited to their own psychological type. So it's sort of, in that sense, it is open-ended. I think it makes no sense to say that all religions are equal, because if you take sort of like Christianity, so Christians will say that Christ represents the truth, the pure divine truth. And you could, so you could say that that is a correct position, but even if that perfect divine truth from Christ emerged in another place in time and among different people, like Christianity would evolve to look very different.
I completely agree with you, Robert. I don't know if you know this, but I'm a tantric Buddhist. So for us, there is like a degrees of truth. There's relative truth and then primordial truth. And then there's also a thing called upaya, skillful means. So it's also a way to get to degree closer to the primordial truth. If you're skillful, skillful can be magical. It can be realized, or can be simply just like something that appears, a phenomenon that appears before you. So that can be a skillful way to sort of push you closer or help you understand the primordial truth. So we're on the same page, absolutely. Not all religions are equal. Not all truth is equal as well. And not all truth is relative. Mostly it is relative, but even relative truth has, there are degrees of it. So some is higher and some is lower. So I'm there with you.
And then when I talk about like the ethics, morality, like what is good and what is evil, is like you do have certain things that are more clear based on the divine order. And then you have things that are more conditional based on circumstances.
So you would perhaps understand causation to come from action?
Yes.
Divine source? Okay. Absolutely. Okay, so let's go into Thergy, and I know this touches on the Neoplatonic elements, which you kind of discussed a little bit, especially as it comes from Origen and Christian metaphysics. But this is a really important concept to me, Thergy, simply because I think that I tend to think of the world as happening in aeonic cycles. So this cycle, and it is just my opinion, but Thergy will be incredibly important, and we're going to see a rectification perhaps of sort of the Christian metaphysical traditions within, I don't know. I think that what we're doing right now, these kind of online, very online discussions that are happening, and it's kind of like rectification of the path. That's what I think is going to happen. That's my opinion again, but I think you're on to something is what I'm saying with the idea of Thergy and and putting it in emphasis.
So it is a way to uplift consciousness and for consciousness to become closer to the higher divine levels of emanation. So like one obvious example is like aesthetics, increasing beauty in the world can bring us closer to the divine by heightening levels of consciousness. And that also, I mean, it also relates to pantheism, the idea that all life has a divine emanation. So I totally reject, the Gnostic view that this world was created by the demiurge, so it's inherently bad, and we have to reject this physical, material world. But rather, the Neoplatonic metaphysical explanation is that this world is sort of the beauty that exists in this world is an emanation from the higher divine levels. So we're witnessing or experience we're experiencing and seeing like a photo, like the equivalent of like a photocopy of a photocopy. So it's not like we should reject it, but it's not like the purest divine source, but like all the beauty that exists in this world does have intrinsic value and should be embraced. So like I reject the Gnostic view. The Neoplatonic view is superior to the Gnostic view about totally rejecting the everything about this physical world. And then also like they're different. You can sort of break down beauty. The kind of beauty that leads to involved in theurgy and hiding consciousness into different forms. So there's natural beauty, the human beauty that inspires romantic desire, and then there's man-made beauty such as music, art, and architecture. So while obviously, so natural beauty, that is the highest emanation, but I would say that man-made beauty, like art and architecture and music, is still very important and has value.
I absolutely agree. I want to say, you make a very interesting point about this tension between Gnosticism or the what I call the popular object of Gnosticism, because there are multiple readings of those texts. Those are just certain cults obviously took it into like more extremist kind of rhetoric. But if you just look at the text for whatever translations we have, I think that they actually can be read in multiple layers of meaning. So I'm with you though, that there is a superior view, this Neoplatonic view, that we should not reject the world or the body. I agree with that as well. But not overprivilege it. It's not that all there is, but come to some kind of balance.
I guess I'm asking, if it's okay if I ask you a question. I know like I'm
absolutely. No, you can interview me. That's okay.
As a tantric Buddhist, what would be your response to some like critics of Buddhism who find the idea of letting go of all of attachment, including like all that's beautiful about this world, critiquing that as demoralizing?
Well, first of all, what are we giving up? So a tantric Buddhist believes that you can interact with Maya to a degree and that it is real to a degree. So the reality is like just to recognize that your desire for things, you're grasping, self-clinging, not being, being too fixed in place, that those things would be hindrances, obstacles for you. But the sort of the Twitter discourse idea of what Buddhism is not really what tantric Buddhism is. And what the Twitter idea is of tantric Buddhism is not also what tantric Buddhism is. Tantric Buddhism is a kind of thergic ritual magic, ritual sorcery that has been applied to the Mahayana layer. So it is a expeditious, a faster, more dangerous, more efficacious at times, to sort of both engage with the world and also sever, you could say, your karmic weight upon it. So it's really so used
being able to sort of, as a form of alchemy, like shift your consciousness between both the worldly and the spiritual realm.
It's about like living in the world as it is, and you have to change within it rather than you put your will. Like, that's a very popular idea in contemporary magic, is that your will is over everything. But we would say in Dharma that perhaps your love is over everything. So maybe love over will, and that would obviously correspond to the Aeonic cycle that I referenced and the sort of meta series that I did, Aeon of the Daughter. But yes, I agree in a broad way, and I think Dharma agrees in a broad way that it's not about the rejection of things. It's not even about the rejection of ourselves. Or, you know, people don't like confinement. They have this, especially online, they have the idea of the black cube, and everything that has strictures and rules is about the black cube. But the reality is Mars and that whole, like, we're going to be the Neo-Templars and like retake America. And like, that's cool as an idea in a way, like as a speculative idea. But when we're getting into like the pragmatic sort of inaction of that, I don't think that that's like a real response. But I also think that that's not a Saturnian response either. I think that's a very martial response. So I think the problem with that is that martial sort of inclinations in people's consciousness. I'm just talking about consciousness, but I'm sort of using an astro psychological layer, maybe you could say, is that it goes into extreme. So a Buddhist would try to come into the middle, Madhyamika. So we want to come into the middle. Everything is about synthesis. It's about not going onto right or left extremes. So it's sort of normie, centrist, maybe you could say, in a way, but it doesn't really have a political view. It doesn't really give answers to politics. But
well, it could be, maybe not talking about Buddhism, but with Cosmoplatonism, like I think it could have for answers to politics, like what I said about what are things that are absolutes and what are things that are more where there can be pluralism and conditional on like where two different groups have this inherent conflict, and maybe both of them could be like ethically right to be fighting for their group interest.
So I think this is really interesting, obviously, because you have done a lot of extensive work on sort of Asian American demographics and that, and I know that's beyond the scope of our discussion, but I do think that there is a sort of layer of Buddhism that has a political response to things, and the political response but is not well understood in the West because it gets filtered through this kind of progressive layer of
like the hippie Buddhist kind of stereotype.
Yes, like, and but it's also like there's a lot of people in Western Dharma that are like what we would call pejoratively North Face Buddhists. So they're like white, yuppie, wealthy, and they embrace like all left-wing politics, basically. Like every single program that they would say, okay, this is fine. And a lot of a lot of lamas in the West, a lot of Buddhist teachers in the West also embrace those ideas because they get filtered into this kind of, oh, we must accept everybody, bodhicitta, loving kindness.
But statement where the Dalai Lama, he like spoke out against replacement migration in Europe.
Well, of course, because
that doesn't fit with like the
that's exactly right.
To idealize him.
That's right. That's exactly right. Because the reality is Tibet, if you want to say Tibet's a polity, it's really a theocracy, and that's okay. I'm not making a value judgment on that, but that's really what it was. Yes, it has had kings. It's had warlords. It's had different sort of formations, but really, it's a theocracy. It's like tied into the monastery system, and it's also tied into regional and Tibetan identity broadly. So I'm not making a judgment on Tibet or China. Like, I'm ethnic Chinese. But I'm from the diaspora. Like, it's not my business. Like, I'm totally out of that. But what I'm saying is it does inform Buddhist politics on the ground. So and it's exactly like what you said. There is a tension between its real world application and its perception in the minds of those quote unquote North faced Buddhists, North faced Dharma practitioners in the West.
I think a big problem with politics is you have these people on both. I mean, both the left and the right, they have these grand political ambitions, and they end up becoming disappointed and disillusioned with politics. But the problem is, like, society can't really be fixed if most people are operating on such a lower ranking of consciousness.
And that is exactly what I find interesting about what you're writing about, but also with what Buddhism's talking about. Because it is about raising us into consciousness through our individual actions. But individual actions doesn't necessarily mean application in the world. It means these processes of consciousness that you're referring to. So that's really interesting. But to go back to your great article, at least the first one, sexuality and romance. So this is kind of obviously a hot topic, because as you even mentioned when you asked me about Buddhism, like, what do you have to give up? Well, cosmoplatonism is simultaneously sex positive and sex negative. You say this in the article. So I find this very interesting, because it is a very kind of, it's a neutral and middle path position, but it's also very, my two favorite things, my two favorite words, plus and ultra. So there's something that's about polarities about it, very much like sexuality and romance. So if you could explain, Robert, what you mean by this and how you think it ties into your greater ontological and cosmological vision.
Well, the metaphysics of cosmoplatonism, there's a hierarchy of consciousness. So there's a lower level of consciousness is with the mundane, where you go into this mode, like where basically how Colin Wilson, the author, describes as becoming the robot, and your consciousness and senses are totally numb. So sexual lust, desire, or even the sexual action can elevate your consciousness above that, like, really base level of, like, every day. And it greatly heightens senses consciousness. But at the same time, it can also, people get stuck in lust, whether we're talking about people who are sex addicts in relationships or talking about, like, incels as well. It applies to all of these groups, but they became kind of obsessed and stuck in that. And that holds them back from reaching the higher levels of consciousness where they're closer to divine. So I view kind of like sexuality, lust, romance as like a middling level of consciousness. But for people who have spent much of their lives in like the lowest rung of consciousness, like when they first become aware of sexuality and romance, like they do experience this intense heightening of consciousness, both sexual and or the feeling of like butterflies in your stomach and color. People will say if they're either in love or have a crush on someone or just have a strong sexual desire, they'll even say that it's a cliche. They'll say like colors and scents become like more intense. So that's true, but it's kind of a middling level of consciousness. But I guess the other angle to it is, and I wrote a whole article about that too, the intersection of spirituality and sexuality. But sexual romantic desire can be broken down metaphysically as these different components. So there's the consciousness, there's the purpose of reproduction and passing down life. Then there are like genetic causes for beauty, and then there's like the hormones. So it's fusing the biological, physical with spiritual emanations. And it is kind of, yeah, like it is like, I don't know if I want to see a spiritual entity or just an emanation, but it's kind of like what Carl Jung called like the anima. So it's like you have a desire for a person, but deep down you're really desiring this greater metaphysical force. And what Plotinus said of Neoplatonism, he believed that every desire is a need for the soul projected onto the external world.
I like this. I think it's very modern. It's like, it's a neither nor. That's very Buddhist idea, like neither nor, to be kind of non-dual in your approximation of the world, or at least try as best we can. So I agree with you that lust, especially lust consciousness, although it doesn't necessarily have to relate to sexuality, and often it doesn't, usually the sin associated with sexuality is actually ignorance. It's just kind of interesting. A lot of Westoids, quote unquote, find that very interesting. So how would you see society arranged in a cosmoplatonic society?
Oh, you mean like sexual ethics, family structures, those things? I didn't really get into that, I haven't really thought about that as much, but I would probably say that going back to the principle, like sexuality and sexual ethics, is there are certain things, like there's sort of the absolute, and then there are things that are conditional upon circumstances and biology. So different things. I don't want to get in, sound too much like a hippie liberal who says everything sexually doesn't matter, because sexual actions do have impacts on people and society. But I think, it's kind of tough to write a platform because different types of sexual morality work differently for different people. And so some people, like the more like what social conservatives advocate, like strict monogamy, may work better for some groups, and some groups might be able to handle like looser sexuality better. And then there are like practical arguments you can make that more social conservatism for sexuality might be better for societal stability. But then the trade-off is that people may not be expanding their consciousness as much. So there are just all these factors to consider. And at some point I do want to write an article or a chapter in like a future book on cosmoplatonism where I address sexual ethics. But right now, like, it's more like there's not really like a clear like ethical code, because a lot of it is sort of based on that principle where there are things that are just absolute as far as ethics go, and then there are things that are conditional, or there are things that have practical purposes. But it's not like if they're not following a certain ethics that they're somehow like morally evil, but they do make practical sense. So a good example is like the value of monogamy for society. Like there's non-religious like evolutionary psychology types who will make sort of that case. But it's a really complex issue. One other thing I'm going to say about sexuality is I talk about how people in a state of lust, one other reason it can prevent them from reaching the highest level of consciousness is because it kind of enslaves them to conform to society as far as like chasing status to gain sexual access. So when it comes to sort of like celibacy and asceticism, like a lot of people will think that's the act of sex that is preventing someone from being spiritual. But in some cases, it could be that chasing like status in order to obtain sexual access, that actually could be what's separating them from higher levels of spiritual consciousness rather than engaging in the sexual act itself.
Well, that's a very interesting sort of comparative mythology you did, or comparative theology you did to the Buddhist version that I sort of spoke about or just briefly sort of mentioned. So I think that's very interesting. And so it is very complex, as you say. So one thing that you wrote about complexity science.
Oh, you mean the section on spiritual science?
Yes.
A belief that science and spirituality are fundamentally interconnected. So which is at odds with this kind of dualism in society between creationism and religious dogma and secular science. And there, I forget the specific, like there was some creed where the Catholic Church made a sort of a compromise with the Enlightenment where they both agreed. I forget the name of this event in history, but they had some agreement where scientific inquiry for the Enlightenment would be allowed, but it would be kept separate from religion. And I think that was a travesty, because science, using science to is much more effective at proving the divine than religious dogma. And there's different angles to look at this. So like one thing is to say just the complexity of life forms and how the universe came into existence, which you learn from science, not from creationism, does just show you that it's incomprehensible that this all could have just emerged randomly out of nothing. But I think the most insightful and important aspect of this in particular is that neuroscience is going to have great breakthroughs in understanding the nature of consciousness, including near-death experiences. And I think those in particular is the best example of how neuroscience can prove the existence of the divine, the afterlife, or the spirit world.
An interesting point, that there is a process of consciousness embedded in divinity rather than it being a fixed object in space.
Consciousness is a divine emanation. So I'm trying to think, like, how did Plotinus and the Enneads for Neoplatonism explain it? So like you have the divine consciousness and then human consciousness, the spirit world, or human souls, they're an emanation from the divine consciousness. And then with how humans function, and there's this sort of congruence of between one's soul, which does have an emanation from the divine consciousness, and the physical body, and how that kind of operates, how some people are more in tune with the divine consciousness and others are just fully in the physical world, and they sort of become more like robots, like the kind of people who don't have an inner dialogue and they're operating on like the lowest level of consciousness. So that's kind of how that metaphysics of consciousness works.
So let us get a little into biodeism and the spiritual genome, which is the next section after theosophy. So I sort of went out of order, but it's okay.
Oh, yeah, like how each religion is formed based on each group's genetics and evolutionary adaptations. So, yeah, in contrast with creationism, like evolution does reflect that principle of emanation. And there is like a genetic code that makes people more spiritual, but different genetic profiles. I kind of went into this earlier with theosophy, that's fine, but like different genetics of different groups of people like reflect how different religions are formed. And so it's, yeah, like it's, if you take religion, it's like partially the divine emanation, and then it's partially like the genetics which create people's psychological profile. And then like certain people, their genetics cause them to become more spiritual or other. And I guess it does get very controversial into issues like genetic hierarchies and against like blank slateism and egalitarianism. But the idea that some people are in a higher level of consciousness that is closer to the divine, it is greatly influenced by genetics. So in a sense, it's like you want to call it a spiritual like HBD.
Well, that's interesting because I know you had actually written some thoughtful ideas on theosophical race science and anthroposophy.
Rudolf Steiner.
Right, exactly, and how there is a very racialist, sort of reproductive racialist element. Obviously, she's drawing particularly from the Vedas. And
I think Blavatsky as well.
Yes, absolutely. They both were. I mean, he was a theosophist, right? Like, he might have distanced himself from the doctrinal sort of institution, but in his core practice, I would say Steiner was a theosophist, regardless of how he rebranded his sort of working model. So, I mean, I don't agree with their sort of racial presupposition of like how spirituality is organized, but I think it's interesting as a speculative idea, and I thought you were very reasonable and thoughtful on the subject. So I should have actually prefaced with that before I asked you about biodeism, but I think you did a good job in fielding that and like bringing the two together.
And I guess I add a sort of another another counterpoint to that, kind of going to the Buddhist idea of having a kind of a middle approach, is that, I mean, I think because all life is an emanation from the divine source, there is some degree of being interconnected. So you do have, like with politics, this divide between egalitarianism and then other sides like nationalism, tribalism, and racialism. And I mean, I think there can be like a dualism approach to that, like having two levels of consciousness, because I think if you think about it, how people do have compassion for tribal outgroups or for animals, I think that is proof of the divine, because if we were to accept a totally Darwinian reductionist view where it's purely atheist, then like genocide of outgroups would, without remorse, obviously that has happened throughout history, but that would actually be the rational norm if we deny like the divine essence.
I think that what you're saying right now is closest to my belief that I've heard articulated. I have a theory, Robert. You can tell me what you think about it. But I think that the sort of Americanization process is actually one of the stages in sort of the liberating of that tertiary or quaternary low state of consciousness. And through that, sort of that Westification, people are more free in their ability to, you could say, switch frameworks when they're not being utilized properly, or if they find something that works better. So I think that that's something very unique to...
Oh, you're saying American culture does not allow for that dualism and splitting of consciousness?
I think it does, but I also think that it's reparative in a way to like a, you could say, quote unquote, third world mindset. Like, I think that the process of coming to America, and for anyone, like regardless of background, I think that that is sort of, in, at least in, that's my opinion. It's just a theory, a conjecture maybe, but it is how I kind of view some of the, we'll say maybe parapolitical or deep political elements in the Constitution and in the founding. That there is like a layer of metaphysics behind sort of why these things are written the way they are.
Okay, I can see that. How America, because of how American came into fruition and questions of America's identity, like because it's a multicultural society but has a kind of civic religion, like it creates, which is obviously, there's many things about American culture that are greatly flawed, or America's political and civic religion that are greatly flawed. But absolutely, there are these different layers, dual kind of metaphysical, almost like metaphysical layers on questions of identity, culture, and politics.
Exactly. And I think that through this kind of like inner questioning, like you see this a lot with like Neoplatonism, is this idea of like inner questioning. And I'm not saying that people don't take it into extremes. Obviously, you can take identity into the way extreme of thinking that, you know, you need a protected class. You are a protected class and need a special amendment to defend you particularly. I think that that is probably not what you're talking about, and it's certainly not what I'm talking about. But I do think that there is a use in having sort of a worldly vessel or worldly kind of nature, worldly consciousness, as you say, and also but being able to sort of wrestle with these greater questions.
And then there is like a kind of hierarchy there. So when you think about identities, like biological identities, like race and gender, I think they're like a lower divine emanation than like the highest divine source. But they're like with sexuality, which is also rooted in biology. They're at the same time, they are a higher level of importance than things that are just things like, say, like crass materialism. So there's a hierarchy there.
I'm not opposed to the hierarchy, so I'm okay with it existing. It's not a paradox for me. So I'll just say that. So I appreciate that you try and look at things, maybe acknowledge that there is a hierarchy in formation, but for me, it's okay. Just simply because it would exist in nature. Like at least some kind of hierarchy. you know, some kind of thing that would change the, it would be the dynamic sort of element in a biosphere or a biome. The Sufis. So I wondered if you could sort of get into this, because this is something I've discussed, so, and I think it's very, a
I
lot
think
of people
what I
are
wrote about with Sufism, which I guess with the history of Sufism is they're referred to as, I mean, this, I know this has gone controversial. I think they like referred to themselves as Muslim as kind of a, well, they will call, I mean, I think a lot of Sufis will call themselves Muslim, but it's sort of like all the Abrahamic faiths have some like non-Abrahamic or more pagan influence. I think they've sort of called them, they've politically identified with Islam as a way to survive. But yeah, like it is, Sufism is heavily influenced by Neoplatonism. And you see that like Judaism with Kabbalah and certain factions of Christianity are more so as well, like Christian mysticism, or but even like Eastern Orthodox has a stronger Neoplatonic influence than Catholicism, which in tune probably Protestant Christianity has the least Neoplatonic influence. But with Sufism, what I wrote about in particular is these different levels of consciousness. So like the Sufis believe that most of humanity spends their existence on the lower levels of consciousness. So the lowest level is the level of beliefs, then the level of social contracts, the level of saint ego, the level of philosopher charlatan, the level of despair, the level of suicidal panic, the level of here and now, the level of pure reason, the level of teaching, the level of bliss, the level of communicating with, of communion with God, the level of ongoing conversation with God, and the highest being the level of reunion with, which is the disappearance of the self and reunion with God after death. So that's what I wrote about Sufism.
Well, I think that was beautifully written and said.
I didn't come up with that. I'm quoting what the Sufis believe.
Absolutely. But there's something really interesting about Sufism just in general, because it arose in the same time as Tantra did in Kashmir in particular during the 5th and 6th century. So I agree with you that there is a deeper metaphysical element. Now, the Catholics, they've played with their metaphysical systems, as you alluded to, and they obviously have the Rosicrucian element, which is very strong. And they you have many saints talking about Kabbalah, Christian Kabbalah, and obviously most famously Pico della Mirandola. But you have a lot of ideas in Catholicism about Kabbalah, but it's never quite articulated. Like, this is what it is. It's more hidden. It's more veiled. And then obviously Eastern Orthodoxy embraces these kind of, they say explicitly that they're non-dual. So like right off, that would be a metaphysical tool to sort of climb the tree, if you want to use that metaphor. And then I used to be in the same belief as you, Robert, that the Protestants did not have that much Neoplatonic elements, but from some of my exposure to people who research Mormons or the early French Huguenots, it seems like there was a strain of at least magic, or at least grimoiric, Solomonic magic that originated in the 13 colonies, and like a Marchionist tradition, as how it's often been referred to. So,
or probably with like Swedenborgianism.
Absolutely. It definitely influenced all of it. So it's kind of like a return, you could say, a return to the ideas. But you're right in to say that they probably didn't, like, it's not some unbroken tradition from, you know, from some apostle or something. It's definitely been reconstituted, remixed, re-identified, re-rectified, re-articulated.
Like I mentioned towards the beginning of the show, that like the theologian Origen, who came up with the Trinity, that was heavily influenced by Neoplatonic metaphysics. Like where you have the source, the divine source, or the one, the divine consciousness.
No, absolutely. And it plays into this idea that perhaps there's a, I don't call it a perennial system, but I sometimes will use that frame because people will understand it. But I actually prefer like a primordialist or even like an Evolian sort of traditionalist to a degree argument, that there is like a kind of underlying metaphysics of the universe, and then all these wisdom sciences are approximating their degree of relative truth about that whatever they believe the primordial truth is. So I kind of see them all interrelated. I see all of the magical systems, especially obviously I'm more Central Asianist, so I look more or think about at least more in what's going on in Nepal in like the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th century, or what's going on in Tibet in like some in Eastern Tibet in some hidden monastery or Tirthan, or finding a treasure text or whatever it is. But I definitely think that the metaphysics are much more closely interdependent and interrelated than most people believe that they are. That's just my personal opinion.
I agree.
So why don't we discuss a little
maybe
bit?
Maybe I think like they're related, but some theologies have a better explanation of the metaphysics.
Absolutely. No, this is absolutely true. And this goes back to the point that you made about it's like rejection of that kind of theosophical universality. I agree with you. So I would say that there are clearly better systems and better tools and better modes of understanding to get to wherever, young dark soul sorcerer wants to go. So with that being said, ethics, morality, good versus evil.
There's a distinction between what are like absolutes based on divine law and then what is conditional. But I guess like the idea, like the Christian term sin, I guess it became corrupted into meaning someone's cursed, but originally had a Greek origin of like a term from archery, which just means like coming short. But what is described as maybe evil or ethically wrong comes from sort of being in the shadows, further away from the divine source, operating on a lower rung of consciousness. So a lack of empathy comes from being disconnected from others' consciousness. But the thing is, like, what gets kind of maybe tricky or almost convoluted is a lot of people engage in depraved, like, sexual acts where they commit violence to heighten their level of consciousness to escape that dim feeling, so they lack the spiritual prowess or even psychological strength to ascend to a higher level of consciousness. Because a lot of behavior that would be described as being degenerate isn't it, like drug use, and obviously like I'm pro like psychedelic mushrooms, and I've written about those experiences, but a lot of like drug use or even like alcoholism is because people are stuck in that lower rung of consciousness where their senses are so dulled, and they need that heightened sense of consciousness and their senses. And I think where it gets convoluted is to explain like what is the metaphysical explanation for why something that is bad will create a more intense level, a more intense experience, a more intense level of consciousness. And I guess one analogy to nature is like if you look at patterns like in the ripples of water, where ripple that's further out might in some cases might have like a stronger hue or of color intensity.
This is a really interesting point. It's something I often discuss on this show and when I go on Rejects or any other show, really, it's particularly in relation to Kabbalah, but it obviously can be more nebulous, like how it's not that you're referring to it nebulously, but you're referring to it in a sort of, we'll say crypto Kabbalistic context, not that you're doing crypto Kabbalah, Robert, but there is idea of like what is that fifth density of consciousness in Kabbalah. So like what is that diamond thunder layer, as I often call it. Obviously I'm borrowing something from Buddhism, but I'm not the only one. So it is clear, but it appears as both turquoise and lapis lazuli, the dark sky of the night. But that's really clear because water is also really clear. The sky is really clear. So the idea is to be at like the greatest clarity that you can be, and like the colors that appear, the blue we associate with it, is just, that's all kayfabe, as the kids say. And so really, I agree with you. There is like a way that people use transgression and antinomian sexuality and antinomian violence to sort of, they believe it will lead them through the kind of process of consciousness, like you said.
And that's kind of like, gets into like dark magic and Crowleyanism.
Absolutely. And so there is a idea that we both live on the carnal ground as well as the garden. So our state of consciousness is like, for a beginner, it's like a JRPG. We go out to the starter town and we don't really know anything. We're kind of innocent of the world, you could say. We have our wooden sword and for 5 copper and our like buckler. We don't know anything. We just know that we have to kill goblins. So that's kind of the idea, is that we start all in a relatively similar position, if not the same position of consciousness. And through praxis, through thergy, which is something that you also talk about in sort of this context, that sort of de-occults or perhaps clarifies our sort of personal body, also our layer of consciousness, and also our surroundings, you could say, to a degree. So it's all relative at the beginning, but then the idea is that you do all these practices and then you get more influential, your sphere of influence grows.
I guess like the kind of ethical or spiritual debate is whether going through the darker spheres of consciousness are a way to spiritually evolve or to avoid, or is it better to avoid them? Is it, and again, like, I think that's really a tough issue, because you want to avoid doing those things that are wrong, but often people do evolve spiritually, or they're able to reach a higher level of consciousness by having exposure to those darker sides.
I think that through pop culture, this is just like a theory that, or idea that I've been playing with, is that through pop culture, people are introduced to specific ideas of the carnal ground, specific ideas of transgression or antinomianism, or sort of, which can also serve, as you were saying, an illuminant purpose, because it's also fictional and it's also into their perception. So it's up to them.
And I guess media sort of mirrors the emanation principle. I mean, emanation usually is to describe something, an emanation from the divine, but it could be an emanation from something bad as well. You could still use that term. But media is sort of an emanation, because people, it's like, or the concept like Baudrillard's hyper-reality, when you're on social media a lot, and it sort of, it consumes your consciousness, but it also numbs your consciousness. So like people who really get addicted to porn addiction, or addicted to radical politics, or watching violence, it's because on the world of media and online, it numbs your consciousness more than in reality. People crave a more heightened level of stimuli, and then the heightened level of stimuli that creates an addiction, because they need more of that serotonin hit.
So we would just call that, it would plant the seeds of craving into someone, and then they would go out in the world and perhaps act on those quote unquote cravings.
Right.
Ghost consciousness, we could call it. So with that being said, let's discuss the avatars, because I think this is really
okay. The avatars. So there's 6, there's the divine source, there's the divine consciousness, that you could say both represent God or different parts of God, and the 6 avatars. One, I gave them names, and I don't know if I can, I mean, I can say them, like Christ, Krishna, Mithras, Gaia, Terra, Prometheus, Eros, Cupid, Ares, those ones, and then I add on ancestral avatar. But the thing is, they are culturally loaded, and I don't know, like, if cosmoplatonism takes off, like, if I should use them, how loaded they are culturally, because there are borrowed of deities from different religions, but the first one represents platonic and familiar love, forgiveness, compassion, mercy, humility, healing the sick, and assisting the soul to ascend to the afterlife. And that's analogous, like, to Christ and Christianity. And about the question, I mean, that gets into questions about more about theosophy and the legitimacy of Christianity, which is important to discuss, but I'm more, in that case, I just wanted to sort of illustrate and explain one avatar from the divine, and then Gaia Terra that represents spirituality, inner peace experienced in nature, and guardianship of the natural and animal world, and a reminder that man is connected to other life forms on Earth. And then Prometheus is the Titan from Greek mythology, and that represents techne, knowledge of art, science, innovation, creativity, exploration, discovery. And Eros Cupid represents sexuality, romantic love. Ares, the avatar of strength and courage and overcoming adversity. And then the ancestral avatar is the importance of remembering history, ancestry, and how spirituality intersects with genetics, and how there's a spiritual component to that genetic lineage that's continuous from one's ancestors to descendants. And then the demiurge, that's not an avatar per se, but that's something else. But if you want to ask about the avatar, go ahead.
Well, I think the demiurge is really interesting because I am a speculative Gnostic, quote unquote.
But I use the term demiurge in a different way that the Gnostics do.
Right. So that's what is interesting about being a speculative Gnostic, Robert, is that I can be very flexible because I'm really a Buddhist. But I think about Gnostic ideas a lot, and I think about how can you change the view on it or the framework around it, or try and look at what the text would say in a more Buddhist reading of it.
So the Gnostics, their view of demiurge is like a lesser deity that enslaves mankind, but I describe the demiurge for cosmopolitanism. It's a metaphysical prison that is created by masses of humans with an inferior level of consciousness.
I don't know if you'd be surprised to hear, but I actually agree with this 100%. Like, no criticism, no commentary, really. It makes complete sense. Ideology is the lowest stage of consciousness. So how do we then overcome the demiurge, Robert?
It's a spiritual enslavement that comes from fear and exploitation-based systems, ideologies, and theologies. Demoralization, conformity, and just acceptance of the mundane or status quo. So I think a really simple explanation is just to heighten consciousness and just to be aware of this. I know this sounds like a really kind of a cop-out or a really easy answer, but I think the only simple explanation is just to have an awareness of this. Because most people who are operating in lower rungs of consciousness don't.
I agree. I think a lot of people will be really interested in these ideas that you're saying. So why don't we close out with the afterlife, because there might be nothing more appropriate than that as a closer.
And I wrote a short article about near-death experiences, but I think...
You'll have to come back and discuss that, because that's a very interesting topic, and I'd love to. I'm obviously going to read.
So the questions of the issue of the afterlife is that the scientific case for the legitimacy of near-death experiences, like, I don't know if I'd say it's 100%, but I think it leans more, the evidence from the testimonies and from neuroscience, they lean more in the direction, much stronger, more in the direction of their legitimacy rather than the direction of the skeptics. And I think arguments against the skeptics are the subject is clinically dead and the experiences are much more vivid and intense than mortal life, or let alone any dream or hypnagogic experience. And that people have knowledge of events that occurred while the person was under. So I would say that is very strong evidence. And then the near-death experiences, they often have commonly shared themes, such as a tunnel of light, a life review, and telepathic communication with the divine. The differences are in religious symbolism, which makes a case for theosophy. But I think where these near-death experiences get really tricky, and this is one issue I get into kind of apatheticism, which is to say, like, what we know, our divine knowledge, is the very tip of the iceberg, is that they do contradict each other theologically, including, like, as far as the nature of salvation. I think much more of them have universal themes, but not all of them. Like, some people do have very strong Christian themes that do match up with Christian ideas of salvation. And that is just, like, I think most of these metaphysics, like, I have very, very strong answers to. This is one issue where I'm totally stumbled. Like, I can't offer an explanation for that. But I will say, even if I can't offer an explanation for that, I do think, like, what Origen believed, the early Christian Neoplatonist theologian, is that the emanation principle is the strongest justification for universal salvation or reconciliation. So analogy of, like, emanation and how souls function, and again, like, with reincarnation, I'm agnostic about that, and I don't really touch on that, but it is analogous to sort of like water cycles, of how polluted water goes for the cycle of purification to become drinking water through condensation and precipitation, or even like how a dead body decomposes and enriches the soil and plant and animal life. But I guess the one issue that I can't offer an adequate response to is how these NDEs contradict each other theologically.
So I've done some episodes on NDEs in the past, and I've talked to Dr. Gregory Shusham, who's like some kind of NDE specialist at UCLA. And so he posits that most of the people that have NDEs they would consider them spiritual experiences rather than religious frameworks per se. Like, there's something they recognize in it, sure. But I would say that's a lot to do with metaphysics as well. Is that there's a superficial sort of soteriological layer, you could say, to the thinking and the dogma and all of that. But then there's also like a metaphysical layer, which is the layer that's more saying something similar, maybe not the same, but something similar than the sort of like outer density or outer temple presentation.
I know Dr. Eben Alexander, he's a neuroscientist who had an NDE himself. And he came from a more like Christian fundamentalist background and became more universalist. Like, he offered an explanation for people who have these kind of like hellish near-death experiences that are used. I think like the Christian fundamentalists will exploit them. His explanation is that they're experiencing an early stage of the NDE where they're either going through a life review and they've lived a bad life and they're re-experiencing trauma, or they go through a dark void, which is often early stage of an NDE, but their NDE is cut short and they come back to life. They'll experience that as a hellish experience. So he makes that case for his argument for universal salvation. But generally, I think the problem is you have both like Christian YouTube channels and New Age near-death channels. Like, they will select the NDE stories that fit their theological agenda more. But my overall assessment is that they do match with something more in tune with theosophy, much more so than any rigid theology.
Well, speaking of non-rigid theologies, I thought what you said about water cycles and reincarnation, although as Buddhists, I have to say we would think of it as rebirth rather than reincarnation. But I think that your water metaphor beautifully illustrates sort of a more Buddhistic idea of a rebirth. So it is exactly like that. And it also refers to the blue pillar in Kabbalah. That's exactly what you could say Netzach, Chesed, and Chokmah are, three cycles of water, with Netzach being ice, Chesed being the ocean, and Chokmah being vapor. So, and that also matches with what you said, Robert, about how the spirits come into emanation, because that's from where they would come. It's from Chokmah, the unmanifest wisdom of God. So incredibly interesting, incredibly fascinating. And well, very well done. So you will have to come back and discuss NDEs with me, simply because I'm personally interested in the subject, and I also think that it's very close to a magical experience. So I've never had an NDE, but I've had magical experiences.
Yeah, I've obviously never had an NDE. I had a mystical experience swimming at June Lake.
That's what you'll definitely have to come back and talk about, and because you have several articles written about that. So I would love to hear about that.
I'm thinking about writing an article specifically about that, even though it happened a couple years ago.
You absolutely should, and when you do, please reach out and consider yourself booked. So thank you so much, Robert. I appreciate it. I thought it was a great conversation. I thought your ideas are really interesting. A lot to do with, at least there's intersections between things I'm thinking about.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Do you want to give a plug and tell people where they can find you? And I am good about, relatively good about including everyone's links, your link tree, your Substack, all that stuff.
I'm on Substack, robertstark.substack.com, and you can find the article. It's linked to, but at robertstark.substack.com, The Metaphysics of My New Religion, Cosmoplatonism. And I also have a website, starktruthradio.com. And you can find me on X, Twitter, at Starkian77789.
Thank you for tuning in. You can follow Robert Stark on his Substack at robertstark.substack or on his website at starktruthradio.com. See you next time.